Catholic Family Podcast presents Lent Around the World, daily traditional Catholic meditations read by our friends from across the globe.
The Passion and Death of Our Lord Jesus Christ by the Most Reverend Alban Goodyear. Part 37. The End. We may glance quickly through the rest of the scene on Calvary, for it has little more to teach us of that which we have set out to learn. The crowd has dispersed. For some, insult and blasphemy had no further meaning. For others, remorse was already gnawing at their hearts. They must leave the place and distract themselves with other occupations. They must throw themselves into preparations for the great feast. They must forget their own consciences in the celebrations of deliverance on the morrow's great Sabbath day. The guards only need remain, the Roman soldiers with their centurion, to whom the morrow meant nothing. If for nothing else, at least, they must stay to keep off the pariah dogs and vultures that would soon hover round. Beyond them at the foot of the rock, a few stragglers still seemed to linger, but these were clearly not of those who had done this just man to death. These were evidently genuine mourners. These were some who cared for the man who was dead, and the guards need have no fear of them. We are told how the Roman centurion with his men was affected by the transformation around them. A few moments before, all had been turmoil and confusion. Now, all was quiet. It was more than the peace of death. From his cross above them, the man who was dead seemed yet to reign. His enemies were scattered, his friends were free to draw near. His last words had been words of authority, independent of all that had been said or done to him. Even these Roman soldiers were moved. They were stirred to something akin to faith as they contrasted this man with the rabble that had done him to death. Be he who he might, he was more than they. And they glorified God, saying, "Indeed, this man was the Son of God." We may reasonably ask whether this further light and grace, this gift to be the first to confess Jesus Christ after he was dead, was due to the last act of charity these Roman soldiers had done to him. It had always been the way with Jesus Christ. Had he not said that not a cup of water should be given in his name, but it should have its reward? In the early days, a Samaritan woman had given him to drink, and in return, he had bestowed on her the light to ask, "Is not this the Messiah?" Now, Roman soldiers had again given him to drink, and the reward he gave them was the same. Indeed, this man was the Son of God. We are further told how all the multitude of them that were come together to that sight returned, striking their breasts. These were the mere onlookers, the multitude of those in the city who had often heard Jesus and had wondered, who had asked each other questions, as St. John many times points out, and had gone away half convinced. Now, the grace won by the death of the light of the world was already being poured out. The prayer of Jesus was already being heard. Already his prophecy was being fulfilled, that when he was lifted up from the earth, he would draw all things to himself. In 50 days from then, Simon Peter would be able to appeal to that same multitude, and they would listen to him. And there were added in that day about 3,000 souls. Lastly, we are told of the genuine mourners, of the women who formerly had followed him and ministered to him in Galilee, who had come up with him to Jerusalem, and now from a distance stood and beheld this collapse of all that life had begun to mean to them. Only 3 women are mentioned by name, but after their names it is added that all his acquaintance and the women stood afar off, beholding these things. Some of these, as we have seen, had been close by the cross before he died, for the same names appear in both places. In the meantime, the guard had removed them to a distance, all the more because of what was about to be done. For it was the eve of the Paschal Sabbath, and before the sun set, the criminals must be dead and their bodies removed. A hurried message was sent across the city to the governor. Two of the victims lingered on, and there was as yet no sign of their dying. A strong man might hang crucified for 2 and even 3 days. It was requested that their deaths might be hastened by the usual process, the breaking of their legs. The permission was given, and the cruel act was carried out. But Jesus was already dead. To break his legs, there was no need. Only to make sure, perhaps to convince any doubting onlookers that indeed death had come, one of the soldiers raised his lance and ran it through the hanging body, deliberately piercing the heart. St. John is anxious that posterity shall ever have before them this item of the crucifixion. So much did it mean to the disciple whom Jesus loved. To those who have come after him, it has meant even more. And immediately there came out blood and water. And he that saw gave testimony, and his testimony is true. And he knoweth that he saith true, that you may believe. For these things were done that the scripture might be fulfilled. You shall not break a bone of him. And again another scripture saith, they shall look on him whom they pierced. By the side of the mourners whom we have already mentioned was another group, of whom we would gladly have heard more. They were men of mark, some of them even Pharisees, who since the beginning of the mission of Jesus had stood, as it were, on the fringe of the crowd, uncommitted. That they were by no means a small number, St. John has already told us. However, many of the chief men also believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, that they might not be cast out of the synagogue. We have met these men often enough in the course of the story of Jesus. There was Nicodemus in the early days, who came to him by night, and who, there is reason to believe, had a following. It was in the house of Simon the Pharisee, seated at table with him as a guest, that Jesus had welcomed the woman who was a sinner at Magdala. It was in the house of a Pharisee that Mary poured the precious ointment over him at the feast given to him in Bethania. More than once, down in Judea, we find Pharisees inviting him to dine with them, even on a Sabbath day. And while there were many there who watched him that they might catch him in his speech, there were others who had not forgotten the Baptist, who had but lately been among them, and what he had said about this man. These in secret had pondered the evidence, had discussed it among themselves, and had been convinced so far as their will would allow them. Had caste permitted it, they would gladly have given him their allegiance. But they were Pharisees, they were leaders of the people. For the sake of them, they must stand together and not yield. And since they must not yield, it was easy to find reason for their choice. If the Baptists and Jesus were right, so also were Moses and the prophets. If he were greater than Moses, still even he had confessed that salvation came from the Jews. And if the Jews were the people of God, the people of election, was it not well to stand aloof, for a time at least, that the whole nation might not perish? With arguments like these, had these men persuaded themselves that they were sincere, and had stood apart from Jesus during the last 2 years. But for some among them, the events of that day had been a rude awakening. Once Jesus had said to such men as themselves, "He who is not with me is against me." And now that he was dead, they might well ask themselves what share of the blame for that murder rested on their shoulders. From among this group, we now hear mention of one for the first time. And a certain rich man of Arimathea, a city of Judea, by the name Joseph, who was a senator, a noble counselor, a good and just man, who also himself waited for the kingdom of God, but secretly for fear of the Jews. This man had not consented to their counsels and doings. It is significant that Joseph of Arimathea is mentioned by all the four evangelists. He was a rich man. He was a senator and a counselor, that is, he was a member of the Sanhedrin. Moreover, he was a local magnate. He had influence in and around Arimathea, and was therefore one to be considered by the ruling foreigner. On this account, he might well have been able to gain access to Pilate, when others, less powerful, might have been refused admission. With the death of Jesus, a new courage had come to him. Before, he had merely looked on and formed his own opinion, convincing himself that the affair of the trial was not his concern. Now, he was indignant at what had been done. He could not make adequate amends, but he would do what he was able. Jesus was a just man, that Joseph knew, whatever charges had been brought against him. Then he should not be buried in the common ditch with the other criminals. In a garden plot close by Calvary was a tomb cut into the rock which belonged to Joseph himself. Many a Jew had prepared round the walls of Jerusalem a like resting place for himself after death. Since there was no other available, Jesus should have that tomb. He himself would secure the body using his influence with Pilate. He went across the city to the governor's palace and boldly demanded an audience. He had come from the place of execution and had a request to make. Pilate, in his turn, was pleased to receive him. In the first place, he was glad to find one of the other side who was not an enemy of Jesus. In the second, he was only too anxious to have news of what was going forward. To the end of the trial, as we have seen, Pilate had striven to save Jesus. Even after he had surrendered, he still hoped, against hope, that his victim might not die. Had Joseph come to make him some suggestion how Jesus might yet be saved? Had he but spoken at the trial, what a difference to Pilate his single protest would have made. But perhaps it was not yet too late. Jesus had been crucified, that Pilate knew. But was it not possible that his life might still be spared? If remorse had already seized upon the Pharisees, much more had it entered into him who had publicly declared the accused man's innocence. But the message and request of Joseph were an end to all these hopes. They were a shock to Pilate, though reason had told him what to expect. But until he had convincing evidence, he was unwilling to believe. An order was sent that the officer in charge at the place of execution should himself come and report. Pilate would hear the final word from no other witness. The centurion came. The facts were only too true. Jesus had died before his eyes. His legs had not been broken on that account, but to prove that he was dead, a soldier of the guard had run his spear through his heart. Thus ended Pilate's last hope. But the respect he had learnt for his victim lingered on. Though he had suffered him to die the death of a malefactor, yet he was glad that Jesus was not to be treated as a common criminal after death. If he had not saved the life of Jesus, it was some satisfaction that honor would be done to the body of this man, who to the end had unflinchingly declared himself a king. Here at least was a Jew, a member of the Sanhedrin, who would give the body honorable burial. And Pilate issued orders that it should be handed over to Joseph of Arimathea. Joseph hastened back and claimed it. With him by this time was another member of the Sanhedrin, Nicodemus, who since the first coming of Jesus had followed his career with care. With the example of Joseph before him, he too had taken courage. A brother that is helped by his brother is like a strong city. From Proverbs. During all the trouble of the night before, he had absented himself from the court. Now, with Joseph, he would do what he could to atone for the deed of his fellow Pharisees. The desire grew to a great longing. Esteem had turned into love. To satisfy himself, he was lavish in providing all that was of the best for the burial and that in superabundance. And Nicodemus also came, he who at the first had come to Jesus by night, bringing a mixture of myrrh and olives, about 100 pound weight. The best of fine linen was brought, the body was taken from the cross, and his mother received it. She, who had once wrapped those living limbs in swaddling clothes and had laid them in a manger, now beheld other hands wrap them round and round with the linen strips of death. She gave a last look at the battered face, and another piece of linen was drawn over it, as is the custom with the Jews to bury. The handmaid of the Lord had done her work. The sword had pierced her heart. She no longer asked, "Son, why hast thou done so to us?" Though she had abundant cause. Though she understood not, she knew more than all the others. But, as St. Augustine well points out, though she knew what would happen in 3 days, that did not relieve the agony unto death of that terrible Friday. Then followed the procession to the tomb. It was cut into a rock, a large square chamber some 8 feet in depth and breadth and height, with a ledge on the rock on one side, on which the body was to be laid. There, therefore, by reason of the perisseve of the Jews, they laid Jesus, because the sepulchre was nigh at hand. The mourners took their last look at the body, as it lay still and helpless on the ledge where they had laid it against the farther wall of the chamber. He was indeed dead. No hoping that they might be deceived, that it was a nightmare from which they might yet awake, could bring him back to life. He was dead, and they must leave him in his tomb. They could not die with him. They could not be buried with him. They must return into the city to a life that was now worse to them than death. The face cloth was again drawn over the face. The men pressed the other mourners before them and rolled the huge round stone at the entrance into its socket. There was nothing further to be done, and they went their way. But the women still lingered on. And Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of Joseph, and the women that were come with him from Galilee, following after, sitting over against the sepulchre, beheld where his body was laid. We cannot fail to be struck by the constant presence of the women in the whole story of the crucifixion. Moreover, whenever they appear, the picture of them that is drawn is evidently true to life. Early in his Gospel, St. Luke had gathered them together and had given most of their names. It was immediately after the conversion of the woman who was a sinner. And it came to pass afterwards that he traveled through the cities and towns, preaching and evangelizing the kingdom of God, and the 12 with him, and certain women who had been healed of evil spirits and infirmities, Mary, who is called Magdalene, out of whom 7 devils were gone forth, and Joanna, the wife of Chusa, Herod's steward, and Susanna, and many others, who ministered unto him of their substance. Since that time, we have learnt of others who belong to the company. We have seen them passing in and out, following where he led, in Galilee and in Judea, faithful to the last. Already have they been mentioned as on and about the hill of Calvary, silent witnesses of this end of all their hearts' desires. Now they have joined in the funeral procession, not loudly lamenting as do the professional mourners of the East, but with grief too deep for tears or words. When the men had placed the body on its ledge in the tomb, they sat down apart on the ground, desolate, their eyes fixed on the spot. There was nothing else in the world that could attract them. But vaguely, hope lingered on. True, he was dead. And what that meant, they were still too numbed by the blow to consider. But he had been their abiding friend and benefactor. What he had done for them could not be measured, and love did not die. somewhere beyond the gate of death, they knew he was their friend and benefactor still. Then, since in life he had permitted them to serve him, now, in death, they would prove to him that their love and service were the same. They waited till the men had done their work and gone. Then we can see them stealing to the tomb, kissing the stone that separated them from their beloved, Magdalene bathing it with her tears, which at last began to flow, wiping it with her hair in a hungry craving of agony. But they would see him yet again, though the morrow was the Sabbath, on which day nothing could be done. Still, on the next day, the first of the week, they could return and the tomb could be opened. Tombs were not finally closed till after 3 days. They would go at once and make their preparations. There was still time before sunset when the Sabbath began. They would hurry to the bazaar. At a time like this, when men of every nation were gathered in the city, they would easily pass unknown in the crowd. They would buy more spices and the other things that were bestowed upon the dead. There was nothing else they could give him. They had followed him faithfully while he lived. To be faithful to him dead was their one remaining consolation. The guarded tomb. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the city was a gathering of quite another kind and temper. Those who had done the Lord to death now felt the need of still clinging together in their own meeting house. They had had their will to the last iota. Jesus of Nazareth had been proved a deceiver before all the world. He had been declared accursed by his hanging on the tree. He was dead and buried, and he would never trouble them any more. And yet, the reaction had followed. A sense of misery and self-contempt, of cowardice and fear, making them dread they knew not what. It was more than the consciousness of murder and injustice that haunted them. There was the warning still ringing in their ears that in spite of all they did to him, he would one day come back to them, seated on the clouds of heaven. They could not endure to be alone. They must needs keep together. They must encourage each other with brave words. Each must hide his shame in the company of his fellow murderers. One thing especially made them restless. Though he had been crucified, though with their own eyes they had seen him dead, though a lance had been thrust through his heart and he had been put safely in the tomb, were they still sure, even now, that they had done with him? They recalled his extravagant boasting, which he had not hesitated to repeat. "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will build it up again. A wicked and adulterous generation asketh for a sign, and a sign shall not be given it, but the sign of Jonah the prophet. I have power to lay down my life and to take it up again." At other times, they had affected not to understand the meaning of his words. He had threatened to destroy their temple. He had claimed magic powers. They had brought these charges against him at the trial. They had flung his words back at him as he hung on the cross, and he had given no answer. But even on Calvary, they had overreached themselves. The very manner of the taunt had betrayed what lay behind it. "Bah, thou that destroyest the temple of God, and in 3 days buildest it up again, save thy own self. If thou be the Son of God, come down from the cross." In the early days, they had asked him by what authority he acted, and only this had been his answer. Later, they had asked him for a sign, and they had been given only what he called the sign of Jonah. But they had known well what he meant. Jesus had spoken to men who had steeped themselves in the law and the prophets. Jonah, they knew beforehand, was a type as well as a prophet. One day, he who was to come would solve the enigma of his story. And now, Jesus had affected to solve it. Jonah, after 3 days, had come back to life. Jesus had said that if men destroyed him, he too, after 3 days, would come back to life. Clearly, this could not be. Dead men did not come back to life, much less did dead men raise themselves from the tomb. Such things did not happen, therefore they could not. They could not happen, therefore they did not. To men determined not to believe, the argument mattered little. Still, it was well to make sure. This man, as they knew and had proved, had cast out devils by the power of the devil. He had more than the power of the devil. He had been himself possessed. Had they not declared it long ago? Do we not say well that thou art a Samaritan and hast a devil? Now we know that thou hast a devil. There were men in Samaria. There was especially one called Simon, who did strange things by magic. Was Jesus different from him? Moreover, who but one possessed of a devil, who but a madman, could boast, as he had boasted, that he could die and live again at his own will? The first part of his boast they had that day proved futile, for they had had their way. He had not been able to save himself, though they had reminded him and challenged him to do so. Not even Pilate had been able to save him. They had done him to death themselves. They had taken the responsibility. They had called down his blood upon themselves and their children. What more was needed to prove that at last they had conquered? Still, there was a haunting dread that all was not yet over. As Herod had once feared the resurrection of his victim, John the Baptist, and could not be persuaded that all was well, so, and much more, did these murderers of the Son of God grow more and more in fear of what might yet be. Besides the prophecies that he had made in his lifetime, there was his attitude during the whole of that day, which had forced the truth upon them that all the time he had been the master, not they. From the moment they had seized him in the garden, he had held them. He had told them plainly that they might do what they would only because he allowed it. Often enough before, in broad daylight, and not under the light of the moon, in the open court of the temple and not under the shadow of an olive grove, he had passed through their midst and escaped them. From the garden to Calvary, they had feared he might escape them again. One who had a devil might do strange things. One who had a devil might work prodigies, though saints might not. After his death, the devil himself might do wonders for one who had a devil. Nevertheless, they had succeeded thus far, and they must seal their success. Dead, Jesus certainly was, so far as any man could be sure of it. Dead he was, and buried. It was now all important that he should be kept carefully fast in his tomb. But how was this to be done? If there was any truth in his boast that he would rise again, for in spite of their assurance, the fear would ever recur, then they might expect weird things to happen in the course of the next 3 days. He had himself fixed the time. Let the 3 days be safely over, and they would need to fear no more. Now, suppose that by some devil's trick he did rise again. Suppose that in spite of the crucifixion, and of the spear through his side, and of the blood and water that came from it, he were not really dead. Bodies inhabited by devils are unaccountable. He might then recover. He might awaken in the tomb. He might work another miracle and release himself from his prison. With such a man, they must be prepared for anything. He must be kept locked in his prison till he was really dead. Even if he did come back to life, care must be taken that he did not escape. The tomb must be sealed and guarded. Dead or alive, Jesus must be kept secure in his tomb forever. Anxious thoughts like these occupied the minds of these masters in Israel during all the evening after Jesus had been dead and buried. They deliberated long. To contend with the dead was no easy matter. At length it was decided that for the critical 3 days that were to follow, the tomb must be guarded. And as they had secured the sentence of the Roman governor in proof of the guilt of Jesus, so they must secure that same witness against all talk of his resurrection. They must ask Pilate for a guard. Of course, with him they would need to change their argument, as they had changed it when they had clamored for their victim's death. For Pilate was not like Herod. He had no superstitious fears of the dead. To him, even more than to the Sadducees, death was the very end from which there was no revival. He had certain evidence that Jesus was dead indeed. If they said that they wished to secure that Jesus did not rise again, he would merely contemn them. They must invent another, more plausible excuse. They must tell him of a rumor that had been bruited abroad, that this man of mystery would come back to life. They would relate to him stories of men who had been buried for long periods and yet had lived. These Romans would believe almost any strange tale of Asia. They would remind him that Jesus had seduced many and had left many followers, hidden, it might be for the present, but fanatics, every one of them. They were dangerous, very dangerous, alike to them and to the state of Rome. One had shown what the rest might do. He had dared to draw a sword and to fight single-handed the whole band that had been sent to take Jesus in the garden the night before. Unless the tomb were carefully guarded, these men would certainly make mischief. They would break it open. They would remove the body. They would give it out that their master had risen from the dead. And what might follow from such a fable? Who could say? For the sake of public order, it was wise that precautions should be taken. Such a nuisance should be forestalled. There had been trouble enough with the tale of Lazarus in Bethania. This tale would be worse. They would see Pilate early next day. Jesus had said he would rise again within 3 days. They might rest secure for the night. True, the next day would be the Sabbath, on which day no business might be done, but the case was urgent, and if an exception could be made to raise a sheep from a well, then, to keep Jesus safe in his tomb, they could give themselves a like dispensation. Thus it was that these meticulous observers of the Sabbath themselves broke the Sabbath on this, the greatest Sabbath day of the year. Onlookers must have stared with astonishment upon these masters of the law as they hurried from the temple up the street to the house of Pilate that morning. They must have known that nothing but a concern of life and death could have induced them to such violation. And the next day, which followed the day of preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees came together to Pilate, saying, "Sir, we have remembered that this seducer said, while he was yet living, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' Command, therefore, the sepulchre to be guarded until the third day, lest his disciples come and steal him away, and say to the people, 'He is risen from the dead.' So the last error shall be worse than the first." We listen to this final sentence and wonder what was in the minds of these anxious men. What was the first error? What would be the last? Had they come already to doubt whether, after all, the doing of Jesus to death was a great mistake? Would it have been wiser to follow the caution of Annas and not the impetuosity of Caiaphas? Annas had shown himself more eager to learn about his disciples than about Jesus himself. Would their cause not have been better served by striking at them rather than at him? But the error, if error it was, had been committed, At least they must not commit the further error of leaving these disciples free to do as they pleased. Pilate was in no mood to receive this embassy with favor. He too had gone through his night of remorse, and he had only these men to blame for it. 24 hours before, they had come to him with their trumped-up story. They had beaten him, and he had yielded to them. He knew he had done the most shameful deed in his life, and they had driven him to it. He would have nothing more to do with them, these restless Jews, these everlasting makers of mischief, these cunning Asiatics whose designs no Roman could guess. Already they had complained of the title he had set above the cross, yet they had come to him at first with some charge about Jesus the King. He had ignored them then, he would ignore them now. He would not submit his guard to the humiliation of watching the corpse of a buried Jew. They had their own police, let them look to it themselves. This at least was a matter that could not be said to be outside their rights. If they could not put Jesus to death in the way they would, they had full right to guard his body. He had washed his hands, he would not soil them any more. Pilate said to them, "You have a guard, go guard it as you know." The chief priests and Pharisees went their way disappointed. This crowning victory over Pilate would have set the seal on all they had done. But at least they had guards of their own. If their police had failed to take Jesus when commanded, if they had come back empty-handed, saying, "Never did man speak as this man has spoken," at least they could hold him fast, now that his tongue had been silenced. In spite of the solemn festival, more work had to be done. On this feast of the great deliverance, when all Jerusalem rejoiced in God who had visited and saved his people, Jesus of Nazareth must be made secure in his tomb. The stone at the door had to be fastened down and sealed. The guards to be carefully chosen, safe men, loyal men, who would not be open to a bribe, who would not be likely to spread false tales abroad. And yet, even then, we may be sure these leaders of Jerusalem returned to their homes restless and anxious, wondering what the morrow might bring. And they departing made the sepulchre sure, sealing the stone and setting guards. Meanwhile, the king lay in state with his guard about him, as became a king.